Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of David Bethard, who was convicted in Sussex County of several offenses. The offense that we're the foundation for which we're contesting in this appeal is Mr. Bethard's conviction for aggravated menacing of Captain Charles Simpson. Now, if I make no other point this morning, I'd like to make one point or leave on the table one crucial point, says for the defense. And that point is that the issue of whether Captain Simpson justifiably used deadly force against Mr. Bethard and the issue of whether Mr. Bethard was guilty of aggravated menacing under Delaware statute and the decisional law interpreting it are totally different issues. For example, counsel says could make, counsel for the state or for anyone who's representing a police officer under these circumstances could make a very persuasive case based upon the evidence at this trial that the shooting was justifiable even if Mr. Bethard was not guilty of aggravated menacing. That Mr. Bethard was guilty of aggravated menacing is not a sine qua non of the justifiability of the exercise of deadly force in this case. So I'd ask the court to consider the arguments that I'm making this morning in that context. The scope of review in this case is that the court, I'll take it from Ward versus State. The sole issue in this case requires us to review the trial court's factual findings and its legal application of those facts to the statutory definition of the offense. This court reviews the trial court's legal determinations for errors in formulating or applying legal precepts and reviews the trial court's factual findings to determine whether they are supported by sufficient evidence and are the result of a logical and orderly deductive process. Now, that is the issue that we're raising says this morning, whether the trial court's application of the facts in this trial on the motion for judgment of acquittal were accurate and whether the trial court's formulating or applying legal precepts, the statutory definition and the court's decisional law interpreting it, those precepts were correctly applied to the facts in this case. We contend this morning that they were not. And that is because if we look at the trial court's ruling on the motion for judgment of acquittal, the trial court has emphasized, and I quote, on the motion for judgment of acquittal, there are aspects of the testimony that he believed it to be a weapon. It's perception. It's what he perceived. And it did not turn out to be a deadly weapon. The perception is the key. Now, we're maintaining this morning that that's inconsistent with the statute and with the court's jurisprudence interpreting as the statute because under Word and also under Walton following it, there is a two-part standard for evaluating whether there is sufficient evidence for commission of the offense of aggravated menacing. And that standard is that standard requires both a subjective component and an objective component.
Okay, at this point, let me make sure I understand how the trial judge erred. Are you saying he erred because he didn't articulate the second point, the objective nature of the evidence, or are you saying there was in the record at the time he ruled no objective evidence on which a jury could rely in determining that Captain Simpson both had a perception that there was a weapon and there was some objective evidence consistent with the possibility of a weapon?
We're saying that he misapplied the legal precept. And by misapplying the legal precept, you cannot, says, evaluate, says, the evidence properly and the testimony properly.
Maybe you didn't understand my question or I didn't phrase it very well. At the time he ruled on the motion for a judgment of acquittal, I believe your argument is he did not articulate the need to make the finding a finding of fact about the second prong.
Correct.
Is that critical if there was, at the time he made their ruling, his ruling, evidence that supported objective facts that a weapon may have been in Beathard's hands?
It is critical because that component, you're looking at the evidence through that lens of whether there was an objective criteria which supported the evidence. So you look at the evidence through that. The trial court did not evaluate whether there was objective evidence of that. Had the court...
So because the trial court didn't articulate how and why the trial judge did so, the fact that there may have been some evidence at the time doesn't save his ruling.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, did the defendant make an objective physical manifestation?
We contend he did not. He removed his hands from his pocket. He removed his hand from his pocket, and that is not an objective physical manifestation that the robber appears to be displaying a deadly weapon. It's not sufficient.
But
removing the hands from the pocket.
There's conflicting testimony about that, isn't there?
Well, there's conflicting testimony, but it's ambiguous testimony, we submit.
But is it enough to get to the jury on that issue?
We believe not, because it's ambiguous.
Are you saying there's a doubt that when he removed his hand, he was holding a cell phone?
Yes. Not that he was holding a cell phone, but that the officer perceived it when the shot was discharged.
Well, that goes back to your perception argument. In the other cases that we had, when the statute provided, the amended statute had the word displayed in it, mm-hmm. you didn't see anything. So the question was, what's your perception of what you don't see that's being mm-hmm. represented as a weapon? Here, we actually have an object that was visible to the officer. So is your focus on his perception of what he's seen?
No, our focus is not on the perception of what he's seen. What we're saying is there's not sufficient as evidence in the record that there was an objective manifestation, meaning an object which looked like a deadly weapon.
Well, when we're talking about sufficient evidence, isn't it correct we're talking about whether there was any evidence in the record from which a rational juror could conclude that there was an objective manifestation of a weapon, recognizing that at least one witness said he had nothing in his hand, and Captain Simpson said he had what he thought almost instantaneously to be a gray object, and he perceived that gray object to be a gun, something along those lines.
But the record is, and this is Captain Simpson's testimony, then he lunged at me and took a fat, this is at A21, I believe, or A76. Then he lunged at me and took a fast-forward motion toward me. The hand that had been in the pocket came quickly out of his pocket. At that point, I fired one round from my divisional-issued weapon, striking him. Prosecutor, did you see anything in his hand? I saw a dark object. I did not know what that was until after the fact. It's not clear whether he fired before he saw the dark object, or afterwards. And that is crucial to whether...
Well, can it be inferred that he saw it before he fired?
I don't believe so. Not if you apply a legal standard that it was perception alone which suffices to establish the commission of the offense.
Well, that's why my question was, is the focus on the perception without the display or with the display? Because the background for this is, you know, the wife saying that he's armed and him saying he's not going to take his hand out of his mm-hmm. pocket, it's all going to end here. So all the buildup is based on an unseen object that there's a weapon.
Correct.
And he wants everyone to think that he has a weapon. But then when he pulls his hand out of his pocket, and the officer sees something in his hand. So something was displayed. Now, the debate that you're having with the court, or our questions, is was the display or the officers seeing the display before or after he shot or fired. But I think a fair reading of the record is they were probably almost simultaneous, weren't they?
Close. But it wasn't clear. It's based upon the evidence, and we maintain that that's not sufficient when you apply the court.
But my question is, why isn't, realizing there's testimony that favors your client, based on the testimony that appears to be uncontradicted, why isn't that enough to make it a jury question? Why, as a matter of law, does this not go to the jury?
Because had it been a different circumstance, had there not been anything in his pocket or in his hand, and he was, then the question could still be presented, whether he committed the offense of aggravated.
But you go back to this case, and the question is, the officer says unequivocally, he displayed something. You're arguing to us that the timing of the display and the firing of his weapon is important. My question is, if the statute focuses on display, we have testimony from the officer about a display, why isn't the timing something that the jury resolves?
Well, it is because if the display occurred, I think everyone agrees that the commission of the offense occurred prior to the discharge of the weapon, or it seems to be that from the evidence. And if there was no objective physical manifestation, if it was solely removing the hand from the pocket, then the question is, could the defendant still be convicted of aggravated menacing without an objective display, says, of a weapon, an empty hand?
Well, why do you say the offense occurred before he took his hand out of his pocket? I thought the whole focus of this appeal was on the issue of display.
It's also evidence, is from the evidence, that, or it's more clear that the officer realized that there was an object after he saw the cell phone on the ground next to Mr. Beathard.
Did you mean an offense, not necessarily aggravating, aggravated menacing?
It could be. There's a question of whether this may have been menacing as opposed to, says, aggravated menacing under the facts. What I'm suggesting is that the court may have evaluated the evidence differently. Had the court applied the two legal precepts that conviction for the offense requires both a subjective belief and an objective physical manifestation, then there is evidence to support the court's finding. The problem here is, the flaw is, that the court appears to have applied only the first subjective belief requirement.
Okay, to the motion for a judgment of acquittal or whatever the terminology is in today's world, did the trial judge charge the jury correctly that they had to make a finding on both elements?
We don't think so. And in fact, I showed the instruction to Mr. Williams just prior to the argument. I was not aware of it until I started preparing for the argument. It's not in the appendix. But
isn't it in the state's appendix, the instruction?
It could be. I'm sorry if I
B18?
Overlooked that. I have it at C35 of the transcript. The Superior Court instructed the jury that the state must prove that the defendant intentionally intimidated Captain Charles Simpson by threat, gesture, or deed with what appeared to each of them to be a deadly weapon. And that's the flaw in that jury instruction, is the same flaw as that I'm arguing here, that the evidence was insufficient to convict him of, menacing, or there was a misapplication of the legal precept by the trial court in evaluating, says the evidence.
Did the defense proffer a contrary instruction?
I do not believe so. Now that, and I'm speculating at this point, but I suspect that that instruction was crafted after Walton and after the General Assembly statute saying that that the person may be convicted if they represent by word or conduct that the person is in possession or control of a deadly weapon. So while that amendment to the statute was addressed to the robbery first-degree statute and not the aggravated menacing statute, the jury instruction may have been modified to address the problem with robbery first-degree. And to address that instruction, the state must prove the defendant intentionally intimidated by threat, gesture, or deed. That is a correct instruction under the robbery first-degree statute, but not under the aggravated as menacing instruction.
Does the pattern in jury instruction incorporate the language of, or the requirements of word for aggravated menacing?
It permits, yes, it permits.
In other words, there's the reference to an objective manifestation.
Correct, but it permits a conviction based upon threat alone, word alone. You know, I have a bomb in my pocket, or under, it says Walton, or, you know, I have a gun under word. So that is the mirror, that instruction, the flaw in that instruction is the mirror of what I'm attempting to present to the court this morning, why that ruling on the motion for judgment of acquittal is flawed, because the trial court, notwithstanding or whether or not there could be or could not be evidence sufficient to convict the defendant, the trial court misapplied the legal precept.
Isn't the real issue whether counsel is ineffective for failing to request an instruction consistent with your argument?
I don't believe so, because the argument we're making is that the court misapplied, says the legal precept, when evaluating the evidence. I'm not making the argument. I don't believe
there's insufficient evidence to support the instruction as a matter of law.
Because the trial court applied the legal precept incorrectly to the evidence. There could have been a different result had the trial court correctly applied the legal precept. That's our contention.
My apologies for interrupting Justice Risley's question, but I wanted to alert you to the fact half of your rebuttal time is gone.
Well, I very kindly request to reserve the remainder of it, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justice Hall, and Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. The issue in this case is fairly straightforward. It's simply whether there was sufficient evidence to prove that the accused displayed what appeared to be a deadly weapon.
Before you get into your argument, what do you make of your colleague's argument that the real focus should be what was displayed according to everyone's testimony just before the shot was fired, not what Captain Simpson testified to in response to the prosecutor's question after he had said he pulled his hand out of his pocket, I fired my regular issued or my divisional weapon or whatever he called it. At that point, the argument seems to be he didn't testify that he saw anything before he fired, and there's significance to that. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know that he said that. I don't think it's thoroughly temporally delineated on a timeline that, okay, I see this, I fired.
Well, that's consistent with Justice Holland's earlier question, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think the evidence is such that it was sufficient here. These things are happening, if not simultaneously, virtually simultaneously. The testimony from Captain Simpson was that the accused, Mr. Bethard, was approximately 6 to 8 feet away when the last crucial incident happened, when he turned away, Mr. Bethard turned away and then turned back, and he was saying that he has something for him, he's bringing it to him now, and then he lunges, and it's that point where he pulls the object out of his pocket. There's also testimony, in addition to Captain Simpson, from an officer to me, another state police officer, And he basically confirms that Beathard suddenly yanked his right hand out of his pocket, and according to Toomey, who's farther away than Simpson, he's in the driveway somewhere, I believe, he says the accused had something in his hand, and it was pointed towards Simpson. So I think you have at least two people saying that he's pulling this thing out. Toomey doesn't say that that happened after the shot had already been fired. So I think a reasonable trier of fact could conclude that the pulling out of the object is what causes the officer to fire. There certainly wouldn't be any reason for him to have fired before then. I mean, he hadn't fired at any other point at that time. And there was this kind of dance going on where they were moving from the minivan, I guess, on the driveway or the side of the house. Mr. Bueller said they were on the side of the house originally, and then they moved to the front yard. So there's some walking and moving back and forward here. But I think given the totality of the evidence, and that's what you have to look at, and the review is de novo to determine whether a rational trier of fact, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, which means you can disregard some contrary evidence if there's other evidence in support of it, would have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Beathard had displayed what appeared to be a deadly weapon. There's certainly a two-part analysis here. The first part is that the victim has to subjectively believe that the defendant has a weapon. And then the second prong or second part of the test is actually an objective test, and that is that the defendant's threat has to be accompanied by an objective manifestation of a weapon. And I think the focus in this particular case is on the second prong, whether the pulling out of the dark object, if that's a sufficient objective manifestation of a weapon. The state's position is that it was, that this is certainly different than some of the other first-degree robbery cases which did employ similar language prior to the amendment. There was a case Walton and a case Word, and both of those, the would-be bank robber did not actually display anything. I think in Walton, the defendant gave a note to the bank teller that stated that he wanted money and that he had a bomb, and that in Word, I think the notes simply said, "I am armed," but in neither one of those cases was there a physical manifestation of a weapon or a bomb or anything of that nature, and that's why
those two. Do you agree that the trial judge did not do the analysis that you're suggesting is the appropriate one right now?
Well, I don't know that he specifically says, okay, the subjective test is this and the objective test is this. He doesn't say that, but this is all in a context of an appellate review of whether or not a motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted. And this is a de novo review that this court does, and the court can look at the evidence. And if this court concludes that, well, there was sufficient evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the state from which a rational trier of fact could find these elements. And that's really the focus, whether the trial judge did or didn't follow all the steps or make specific findings or not.
Do you agree that the jury was not instructed consistent with this analysis?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I guess that's a plain error claim that's being asserted today. It wasn't really argued in the brief. But if you look at B-19 of the state's appendix, well, that has
before
the...
Before you get into merits, your point, which you made almost as an aside, it really wasn't argued in the briefs?
Yes.
And it certainly wasn't made below, from what we can tell in the record. Is it something, then, that we should not be concerned about?
No, I think you can look at it as plain error. I mean, we don't want to have to do this
later. Haven't
we said
if you don't raise an issue in your brief, it can't be considered on appeal, even if it was preserved perfectly?
Yes, that's the waiver, and we argue that all the time when people don't do that. I mean, the problem we have is that if we don't confront it now, we'll confront it later in the Rule 61, and we'll be back here. I think it's You know, technically, yes, it's been waived, and the court doesn't have to consider it. But if you want to consider it, it's been brought up today, and
okay.
I'll certainly address it.
I just wanted to make sure that you weren't making the point that you're discussing it, even though you shouldn't be. You're making the point that you're discussing it, even though you may not have to, because it may avoid a problem later down the road.
Yes, that's the only reason. I mean, I don't want to waive the waiver argument, if that's an appropriate way to phrase it.
Sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. But I think if you look at B-19, where the instruction starts, the judge is laying out the different elements of the aggravated menacing thing. And he says, I think it's line 10 and 11 there. He says, as to count 13, this is the aggravated menacing count vis-a-vis Captain Simpson. There were other aggravated menacing counts as to other individuals, but this is the one specifically that we're concerned about because that's the only aggravated menacing that Mr. Beathard gets convicted of. He says, as to count 13 in this case, the defendant displayed what appeared to be a deadly weapon to Captain Charles Simpson. Now, I think that's sufficient to meet what is the objective test. There has to be a display. The instruction, I'm assuming this is either a pattern instruction or a variation, it looks like it. That's sufficient. The court doesn't have to tell the jury, and by the way, you have to do a two-prong legal analysis, and you have to determine first the subjective intent of the person, whether they were intimidated, and then you've got to make the subjective finding. We don't require juries to make those kind of finite judgments, and I think telling the jury that there has to be a display, that that's sufficient. Normally, instructions are read in total, and the part that has been focused on this morning actually starts at the very bottom of B-19, line 23, says the state's not required to prove that the defendant actually had or used a deadly weapon while committing the crime, and that's consistent with the case law. It says, however, the state must prove, this is now B-20, the state must prove that the defendant intentionally intimidated Cherry Esslinger, Tiffany Fithian, Gary Call, and Captain Charles Simpson by threat, gesture, or deed with what appeared to each of them to be a deadly weapon. So I think that's really focusing on the subjective perception of the victim. And that's where I think this language in the alternative threat, gesture, or deed comes in. And I think that's appropriate. You could certainly have the subjective element satisfied by the mere threat. You don't have the display or the physical manifestation element displayed by that, but I think if you read the entirety of the jury instruction, that the instruction is not defective in this case, even if it's reviewed as plain error or not. Back to the rest of the case, I think there was an objective manifestation here when Mr. Beathard pulls the dark object out of his pocket. That's what's required, and that was what was missing in some of these earlier first-degree robbery cases, such as Walton or Word. The individual just said they had a bomb or said they were armed, but there was never anything actually shown. The DeShields case is kind of interesting because in that one, the individual puts his hand under his T-shirt and his belt, and the store clerk sees something heavy and bulky being pointed toward her when he's demanding money from the cash register. And that's a sufficient display, too. It doesn't have to actually be pulled out and visible. As long as you're making some sort of manifestation pointing to something on the person's body or secreted somewhere, and that an objective person reviewing that or an objective analysis of that would lead to a conclusion that, yes, perhaps that's a deadly weapon. That's all that's required in this particular case. The Superior Court correctly denied the motion for judgment of acquittal in this case. The trial judge did look at Word here, and I think he's focusing, when he talks about the perception, he's talking about the subjective element here. It's not totally clear because he doesn't specifically break it down to, well, this is a subjective analysis, this is the objective. But I think a reasonable reading of that is that both elements were satisfied in this particular case here, and that this was a situation that could be submitted to the jury for determination here.
Well, when you say the reading of that, Do you mean the reading of his articulation of why he denied the motion for a judgment of acquittal, or do you mean a reading of the evidence that existed in the state's case?
Well, I think it's the latter, the reading of the evidence in the state's case, or the reading of the evidence viewed in the light most favorable
there,
to the
there
state.
There is no question that in his ruling denying the motion for a judgment of acquittal, he didn't discuss the significance of Simpson seeing a dark object either just before at the time of discharging the weapon. He didn't relate that to word second prong of objective evidence of something that might have been a weapon.
No, I don't think he articulates it in that fashion.
Okay.
But I think this is, as I said, a de novo review. This court can look at the entirety of the record here. And that looking at the entirety of the record here, there was sufficient evidence from which a rational trier of fact could conclude that Mr. Beathard was guilty of aggravated menacing, at least as to Captain Simpson. If there's any additional questions, I'll certainly attempt to answer those. I think it's a fairly straightforward issue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to address one point in rebuttal, and that is ironically that we seem to agree that the critical issue here is the objective physical manifestations of a deadly weapon. And we're considering that because of the way the trial court analyzed it, there's insufficient evidence to prove that because the trial court didn't rely on evidence, didn't point out that it was relying on evidence of an objective physical manifestation. It's almost like this situation. I was trying to think of an example. Officer tells you to take your hands out of you've got your hands in your pockets, let's say in the back pockets. I don't have a cell phone on me, but and the officer says, take your hands out of your pockets. You've said, this is going to be bad, or you've used ominous language. You take your hand out, it says, like this. And the question is, or another alternative, take your hands out of your pockets, or you go like this. There's a difference in those two acts. Conceivably, this could appear just like a deadly weapon. You're intending to appear like a deadly weapon. On the other instance, there's a cell phone that says yes, but the question is whether or not it's sufficient to commit says the act is a different question depending upon those facts, and it's not clear from this record and from the trial judge's ruling whether the precept of law was correctly applied to those facts, whether it's the facts in this record or the facts in the demonstrations I've just offered. If the court has no other questions,
thank you very much.
Impressed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
we'll
you.
Take the case under advisement. Recess.